Tonight is Wednesday, the 27th, right, of January, 2010. And I presume, can you hear me okay in the back? The acoustics are a little funky here. Let's see, as we normally begin our practice, it's been our practice, is there any question or comment that you'd like to offer? Great. Are there any wishes? So, for how many people was the sound of the furnace, you know, at all a distraction or bother? So it's a small number of people for whom it was an issue.
And if you're sitting out in
well, right off the top, I'm practicing with my discomfort about, you know, putting myself on any kind of a box here. But, so how many of you have ever been to Esalen? Most of us? I had never been there before. It had been legendary. And it really, for me, is everything it cracked up to be. It was purported to be. It's really quite extraordinary. Shangri-La, as I said to someone earlier, it's like Disneyland for grown-ups in a lot of ways. And what's not, and so that was the Esalen, a very special energy. You know, the watchwords really there, just kind of casually, someone was talking with me as I was checking out, and he said, yeah, there's something about the air, the atmosphere, the light, that leads people to soften and open. Just those two words, soften and open, which actually does relate, in my mind, to our theme tonight about what the Buddha highlighted as one of the really important ways of doing practice that leads to liberation, which is clearly knowing. So how do we clearly know? One way we clearly know is we soften and we open to what is. So that's true. To be have the opportunity to reflect on this marvelous material in the Dharma and then weave together other modern influences in terms of my own background in Western psychology and neuroscience, as well as, you know, just kind of enlivening it with coming up through the 60s and the 70s and all the rest of that. To be able to do that, any one of you, I think, can imagine how fruitful that is. And it's something I highly recommend to anyone in this room who's so inclined. That, as they say, you learn mainly by teaching, you know? And the chance to share with you and to feel encouraged by you all, really, and to feel that what is streaming through one is actually of value, at least some of the time, to other people, at least entertaining, usually hopefully valuable. That's a beautiful thing, you know, and I think it goes to this thing I see in adolescents, teenagers, and I see in a lot of people, and I think is a real theme for people in their life, which is deep down, I think everyone wants to be of value. The way they think they should be of value may be somewhat misguided, who knows, right? But I think in all of this is this great desire to offer our gifts out into the world. And I've often felt that the greatest suffering is thwarted love. You know, if you can't share your love, you can't offer in some way, that's a real wound. And then you deal with that as best you can. So. Yeah, for me, this is an opportunity to feel of use that something is streaming through, and that's just an incredible reward, and I hope it's one that you all take up in your own way, in your own world. It reminds me a little of the story you may know of Nelson Mandela. Apparently, when he was at Rikers Island in taking big rocks and breaking them into little ones and then into gravel. He began to despair that he would be forever separated from those that he loved. And after having his own kind of dark night of the soul, he realized that there were people all around him that he could love, including the guards and the jailers who oppressed him. And as the story goes, he started loving them. And as he loved them, he, of course, was rewarded by that act of love. In other words, he was giving what he could where he was. And increasingly, of course, those guards could not mistreat him. So they got rid of them and then brought him some new ones. And he just go to love on them too. Go to love on them. Go to work on them, you know. Go to love on them too. And I was talking actually with somebody at the break about, you know, whether we have influence or control over our life. And I think one of the most fundamental things that we actually have influence over ourselves is whether we orient to the next moment in the most positive way we can, right? Particularly in the most loving way we can. And I actually said this at the Esalen workshop, which was a new thought for me, which is, if you think about it, as you go through the lifespan, let's say time goes this way from your perception, you know, your left or right, whatever, it's arbitrary, but let's say it's this way. At any moment in time as we go through time, right, there's a range of what's authentically possible for us in terms of, let's say, being loving or giving in that moment. And the question then is, of course, what do we do at each moment in terms of our range? Do we default, as I think many people do, to the low road? Or do we take the high road moment by moment by moment by moment as we go through life? That really is something where I do think we have influence over what we actually do moment to moment to moment. And any one of those choices, you know, the delta, if you will, in, you know, mathematical language or business language, between the increment, between the low and the high, usually is more like this. You know, I just kind of expand it. It's like a Google map blowing it up so you can see the street, you know, street numbers. But it's really about this big, moment by moment by moment by moment. Boom. But the slow accumulation of little things, of the little choices we make about whether we sink down to the low end of the range, to the low road, or whether we take the high road, particularly in terms of this quality of generosity and doing our best and inclining toward others and being forbearing. And, you know, in the Buddha Dharma, practicing virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom, the three fundamental pillars of practice, to the extent we practice that moment to moment to moment to moment, we determine whether our, you know, the trajectory of our life is like this, or in the cases of some people who shall be nameless but who may recently have occupied the White House, like that, and declining. They know less at the end of 8 years than they did at the beginning. Or is their trajectory more like this or even like that? As the result, the direct result earned in the real world, in the trenches, by the choices we make moment to moment to moment between the low road and the high road in terms of the range of options we have before us at any moment. I just think that's a beautiful thing. Wherever we are in our lifespan, from here on, those choices will accumulate to determine the angle of our trajectory through life. Steep, moderate, shallow, flat, declining. Thanks. One more, and then, yeah, you, and then. Yeah, that's a beautiful question, and a deep one. First, there are lots of individual variations and surprises and mysteries about sadness. And let's distinguish between mood and temperament, where there is kind of a set point. You know, some people tend to be fairly kind of cheerful in their temperament. Some people tend to be a little anxious. Some people tend to be a little irritable. some people tend to be a little melancholy. These are the kind of classic four temperaments, right? And that's different from what I think we're talking about here, if we could say that. So let's suppose then that the sadness is related to events and then how they landed, whatever it was. Loss of a loved one, a divorce, a frustration, a mistreatment, taking some bad choices, recognizing our own errors, whatever the sadness is due to. Okay. The question is then, is it natural to stay sad for a long period of time? And I think for some people, my personal opinion here, I've never seen a study about this, I doubt there is actually. I think for some people, the truth is, there is a fundamental, I think of it as the bucket of tears. They will go through this life with a bucket of tears. And it's real, it's part of their orientation, things have happened. How do you not continue to be sad if you have a child kidnapped? Right, that you never see again. I mean, how do you not, right? Or how do you, if you're a victim of war, and your village has been just burned to the ground and half the people killed, how do you, you know, it's there. What I'm mindful of, though, or reminded of, is this wonderful word, I think it's in Japanese or something, I'm going to do it wrongly, like abasabi or something. And it kind of comes from wasabi mustard or horseradishy stuff. It's this idea that there is sorrow or grief or discontent surrounded by contentment. And I think that's the question. Yeah, both are present rather than just one. And then I think there's the question of where does the tension rest? And in ways, I think there's a choice a person can make where increasingly they know that they're not denying the bucket of tears. My best friend lost his son to cancer when his son was 19. And I talked with him one time about it, my well-intended psychologist kind of way, and said, you know, do you ever want to talk about it? Maybe make it better. And my friend has great integrity and depth. And he said, well, you know, I tried that for a while, but I learned that every time I talk about it, it just hurts like hell. Of course it hurts like hell. And it's not going to not hurt like hell, you know? So then I think the question becomes, what's productive and broadly defined, or what's useful, or what's consistent with one's values in terms of the results? Again, little choices we make, you know, that we do have influence over. Does it help me to really dwell on that loss? You know, attention in the brain is like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. It illuminates what it rests upon, but it sucks it into the brain. Because attention really stimulates the neural circuits that are involved in whatever it is we're attending to. So we ask ourselves, if I'm feeling into this, am I honoring the dead? Or, you know, perhaps, am I opening to my experience? Am I just letting things flow? Or am I getting kind of increasingly drawn in, almost like a black hole, into some particular piece of mental content that's kind of capturing me increasingly? That's, for one, just making me feel not so good. For two, maybe getting in the way of practice. For three, you know, kind of drawing me away from other areas where I might be able to offer more to other people. And I think that kind of is the rub at that point, you know. And that also, I think, gets at what do we know about our own strengths and weaknesses. My personal tendency is to move away from emotional pain to a fault. And so I deliberately really watch out for that and try to put a correction factor in. I think there are other people who are very balanced about this sort of thing, and there are other people who just are very drawn to it somehow. And I think there the correction factor maybe is to kind of move the other way. But I think the ultimate, of course, or the penultimate maybe, is to be able to regard every single one of those experiences as empty in some sense, as phenomena that arise and pass away in the mind, whether it's sadness or happiness, it's just all empty. It's all phenomena. And you can start to feel like it's kind of shimmery, almost, or gossamer-like, like experience is shimmery. Almost like you can start seeing through experience. It's so evanescent, it's so transient. The sights we see, the sounds we hear, the thoughts we have, the sorrows, the joys, they're transient, and you start seeing through them. And in that, then, you start relaxing and loving increasingly deeply. Is that German? It was deep tonight, wasn't it? Just sitting, it was very deep, and now these and the feeling in the room. Oh, yeah, one more, and then I will try to talk about clearly knowing and the handout, no less. Yes, please. Yeah, I think that's really often the case. I just want to acknowledge, I guess, diversity, you know, and the people, and sometimes the wounds, where if you go in, you know, you don't get out. You're just there, and it doesn't flow. It's there. So I think what you're saying is, see, I'm a kind of guy who really needs to hear what you're saying, right? Additionally, I think there's some people who really need to hear what my best friend Tom said, that there's some wounds that you land, you burn, and you don't stop burning until you get off the hot plate. Any single time you get on the hot plate, sitting on the hot plate never puts the hot plate out. I'm mixing my metaphors here, but I think you know what I mean. You know, I want to validate what you're saying, if I could, but just, I think there's another part of it, too. Thank you for that. Really, thank you. What we've been talking about is how to really use in our own life what the Buddha laid out as who, and the Buddha was a just extraordinary practitioner, very, very skilled in his own practices. And he said, you know, if you really are interested in relieving your suffering, even going all the way to the complete uprooting of all causes of suffering in this life or any other, one direct, sometimes called the one-way path to that, is through a deepening mindfulness of the body, the feeling tone of experience as pleasant and pleasant and neutral, the general attitudes of mind as leaning toward the wholesome or the unwholesome, you know, leaning toward the high road or the low road, and then some key topics. If you zero in on those four foundations of mindfulness, that'll take you all the way. And so we've been unpacking that, beginning to unpack that, and that's a lot of our focus this year. Because when the Buddha says something like, you know, here's the practice, it's about 8 pages long, you can read it, follow these steps. Really, I promise you, he's saying, you know, if you genuinely engage this in the right way, it'll transform your life. So I think that's pretty interesting stuff to understand and then work with in a feeling way. So last week, we zeroed in on what's called the definition part of this Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, or Sutta, and which describes basically how we should approach these four different things we are to be mindful of. So I photocopied some of these from the definition portion, and I'll just pass them out right now. And we looked at these last week. And last week, the key word we focused on was diligent. Sometimes it's very powerful to take a word and actually unpack it. We also talked some about what it means to be, in the last phrase, to be, to have abandoned, essentially, you know, longing and dejection, sorrow, with regard to the world. Tonight I want to talk about clearly knowing in an interesting and different, for me at least, kind of way. So I printed up 30. I've got a few more. I think there might be more than 30 people here. If there's someone near you that you can look over, take a look, if you will, at the very first paragraph in bold and the lines that one is clearly comprehending. Do you see that there? Harold, just for getting the voice, would you be willing to read the first, you know, paragraph in bold?
Here, monk, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, reaching desires and discontent in regard to the world.
Okay. So, it's easy to glide over some of these key words. But I want to talk about clearly comprehending. Because if you think about it, there are four sort of attributes of the mental attitude that is really fruitful when we're practicing. We are diligent, clearly comprehending, mindful, and free from desires and discontent. Sometimes they're called longing and dejection with regard to the world. And in effect, those four really get at energy, which is to say diligence, wisdom, which is to say clearly knowing, mindfulness, which is mindfulness, and concentration, deep states of absorption where the hindrances are not present and we truly have no longing or sorrow with regard to the world. So pretty important. Now, clearly comprehending is actually very interesting, and I want to talk about it. Or clearly knowing. The Pali word for that is sampajana. You know, sati is mindfulness, sampajana is knowing. There are other words for awareness and attention and wisdom. And these are pulled out as separate factors to help us along the way. So let's take the breath. If we, as you followed, I gave basically clear knowing instructions or suggestions tonight. In other words, breathing in long, know that you're breathing in long. Breathing in short, know that you're breathing in short. Breathing out, know that you're breathing out. Breathing in, know that you're breathing in. That's clearly comprehending. Most clear comprehending is not verbal. Sometimes getting verbal about it gets in the way of clearly comprehending our experience. Okay? Another thing that helps clear comprehension is to soften and to open. As we soften, we open, we're present. We're present with the breath. We're present with our friend. We're clearly seeing what's here, right here. That's what this is, just this. This is this, that is that. There's a quality of acuity, of intelligence there. This notion of clearly comprehending undermines the very common way people meditate, you know, sometimes me included, where there's a kind of fuzzy, foggy, relaxed, spacey blurriness. How many of you ever experienced something? Yeah. It's pleasant, isn't it? And I think it's better than being jangled. And I think it's good in that it gives us a stress relief benefit and, you know, it helps us sort of deal with our life. And I think there's something kind of chelating about it. You know, it sucks toxins out of the mind, you know. That's what chelation is. But it's not deep practice. Deep practice has, which is to say the kind of practice that liberates us from suffering, has an acuity to it, has an intelligence to it. It's not intellectualizing. It's not a lot of interverbalizing. There's just a knowing. There's a knowingness that's brought to our experience. Without that knowingness, in other words, mindfulness, the Buddha was clear. Interestingly, there's been a kind of idolatry of mindfulness, I think, in Western psychological circles and also even in Buddhist circles. Right? It all seems to be about mindfulness. People talk about mindfulness meditation, mindfulness this, mindfulness that. All right, mindfulness is better than nothing, but a sniper, a burglar, is very mindful. Doesn't mean it's going to lead to liberation. Right? So the Buddha said very clearly, that mindfulness without wisdom, in other words, without clearly knowing what's there, what leads, where are you in the delta here? You know, are you at the low road or the high road? That's clearly known. Observing what results from taking the high road or the low road, that's clearly known. There can be a continuity of clear knowing. It's important, it's valuable. So one thing that facilitates it is a kind of softening and opening to the present moment as it is. That helps us clearly know. Another thing I've been really watching lately as I've reflected on this clear knowing thing is this phrase, busy brain, rattled, frazzled mind, basically. And when our brain is so busy with emails and tasks and to-dos and phone calls and racing to get from point A to point B, juggling multiple things, stirring the spaghetti with a child on our hip, with our phone, talking to someone, setting up the play date next week or something, all that, right? That's a really busy brain. And isn't it interesting, if you watch carefully, it's hard to settle into the mode of clearly knowing with a busy brain. Busy brain, frazzled mind. And so I want to take a moment here to talk about slowing down. What's involved in slowing down? Because when the brain is busy, it's really hard to clearly know. Like if we're simply settled in with something like the breath, or clearly knowing what a person is saying to us. So often, isn't it the case that someone comes up and says something or asks something, and we just react? We don't take the extra 5 seconds to slow down, to look, consider different possibilities, and come to a clear knowing. We don't do that. And yet if we do that, doesn't it make all the difference in the world? I mean, how often are we on the receiving end of someone doing that? When I say these words right now and I think how much it means to me, when I'm with someone to whom I speak and you can see them pause and reflect and take in and then in fact kind of lean toward and almost inquire and look, and all that has happened in about 8 seconds, and then respond from that clear knowing on their part, really opens the heart, doesn't it? Really makes me feel grateful and and cared about, and then very inclined to treat that person well. You know what I mean? So when we feel how much it matters to us to be on the receiving end, doesn't that inspire us? Yeah. I feel actually a little ashamed inside of the times I don't give that to people, including those nearest and dearest to me. So it can inspire us to give others that quality of slowing down just a little bit. Again, it's in that incremental range. It's just a little bit. But it's this end of the range rather than that end of the range over and over and over again. And those differences make all the difference in the world. What do you think about this notion of slowing down and using that, slowing down globally, but also slowing down situationally as a way to settle into, whether it's in meditation, we kind of speed up, we're speedy in meditation, rather than letting things come to us. We're often speedy in life, rather than just sort of slowing down and clearly knowing what's there without feeling burdened by the need to be productive in some way. So I want to have a little discussion here, if we can, about slowing down as a pathway into this critical one of these four factors of mindfulness, which is clearly known. There you go. Thank you. Suitably active. Great. So what do you experience when your mind is really, or your brain is really busy and your mind is frazzled, compared to when you slow down a little bit in this range to clearly know what's right here and now, especially in relationships or engagement with other people. Yeah, please. Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. I'm reminded of the old saying, the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. And then we can go out, infinite regress, right? But the really most important thing is to remember that it's the most important thing is to remember the most important thing, or something like that, right? Watch words around us. Little reminders, like pictures around, icons. You know, I do collages, and I stack them up in my office at home. They just kind of, when I look at them, it entrains me, if you will, into that way of being. Another thing is, and I'm calling myself on this, trust me, is to add fewer things in the hopper, which then inevitably entail massive amounts of busyness or activity, there we go, to process out the other end in the sausage maker. Yeah. You know what I mean? Don't throw, well, I could forget the metaphor. I'm like popcorn brain as far as metaphors go. But anyway, I think that's another thing too, is to take on fewer things. You know, it's we front load. And the other thing, honestly, I'm reminded of, how many of you have ever read Sweet Thursday? You know Steinbeck's book? So few. I really recommend it. It's a beautiful love story, magnificent writing, deeply thoughtful, very funny. Steinbeck, I think, that and East of Eden, his best novels by far. He didn't get a Nobel Prize for nothing. And anyway, in that novel, and I won't ruin it for you, there's a love story fundamentally between a true character who was a marine biologist in Monterey called Doc. And then there was, in the fiction, there's a woman who comes to town from the wrong side of the tracks. And she and Doc hit it off, and he invites her. He has a college degree. I think he probably has a master's, even a PhD. And he invites her to a really elegant restaurant for dinner. She's never been in a restaurant like that in her entire life. And you can just imagine her. She thinks he's pretty great, but she's got a lot of moxie, a lot of self-respect. She doesn't want to play the fool, but she doesn't want to embarrass herself in that quite nice, elegant setting. And what she discovers is that if she just slightly slows down and gives herself the gift of time, moment to moment to moment, that little increment there, give herself a little longer to observe before she reacts, to pause before she speaks, to watch how, which fork Doc uses for the salad, and then that's the fork she chooses for himself. How does he put it back? How does he speak to the waiter? How does he handle the wine and whatever, all those things. She just slows down a little bit. She buys herself time, and she realizes at that dinner, too, that the people who struck her as the most admirable and dignified and sort of elegant actually moved with a sort of grace, a sort of liquid fluidity that did not have a racing, busy, jangling, frazzled quality to it. So, making oneself slow down. It's a great practice to do something like if you make coffee or you get up in the morning or you respond to someone, to make yourself do so occasionally in a slower way. You know, reach for the glass of water a little more slowly. not like you're some robot, you know, or some Esalen or whatever. You're like, oh, the bass, you know. But, you know, those, I think those are really good touch points, too. Yeah, please. Yeah, more. So how about Harold than you? Okay, first Harold.
I think what I'm coming to myself is it's not just about slowing down a pace, but it's about balancing a mind awareness or a brain awareness, lowering that and raising awareness of the heart.
More in the heart, more in the body. Is that what you're saying, Harold?
Definitely more in the heart.
Yeah.
The
yeah. Because the brain's in the body too, but that's what you mean. But in this particular
heart awareness of
yeah,
what's going on.
Really draws us into that slowing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the and clear knowing. Thank you. Yeah, I feel that too. Yeah. How about you? Yeah.
I struggle so much with this.
Yeah. Or at least take the dog for a walk, you know. Well, I have worked in the business world a lot, actually, and a couple thoughts about that. One, inadvertently, I was giving a talk once, literally to the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce. So there were 100, 150 people in the room. This was about 20, 25 years ago, I believe. And so I had my presentation on this was for small business owners, because that was pretty much my expertise about business. And if I recall correctly, what happened was that I got to a section, somebody asked me a question, and I just paused to think. And I'd led enough workshops and given enough lectures that I'm comfortable in that world. And so probably there was, you know, on the radio, it would be like 6 seconds, 7, 8 seconds of dead time, air time, which felt like an incredibly long time. But I was just looking at, you know, the chart, and reflecting and thinking very quickly about a lot of things, but I allowed myself the time. And then I spoke. And I had a number of people come up to me and they said, you know, the thing that was the most helpful in your whole presentation is you let yourself stop for 6 seconds to gather yourself and then go forward. You felt okay to do that for the 6 seconds, right? And I think that's a useful thing, just in general, that just to insist. I mean, Obama, to me, is a guy who's like that. People ask him questions, he will not be hurried. And then, you know, that's a very important thing. The second thing I have seen a lot when I'm in work environments too, is this whole idea that for me to give you what you want from me, you know, in other words, for me to give you the answer to your question, or for me to give you the support you want because I'm working for you and trying to make you a star, or you know, for me to give you this report you want by Friday because you're my boss and I work for you. I really want to do that. I'm totally for it. And for me to be able to do that, I need this and this. I need you to stop yelling at me so fast. You know, I need to be able to go to my office, close the door, and think in a focused way with a calculator for 20 minutes. And I promise you, check your watch. Minute 21, I'll be back with an answer. That's what I need. You know, or for me to make you a star, boss, I need you to get me the information at least 3 days in advance of when you need to report that or something. Can we do that? See what I'm saying? The frame is, in the Western novel language, I'm writing for the brand. My loyalty is not in question. That's what people want to know. Are you with me or not? Right? So we establish I'm with you, which calms other people down. Because they're like, ah, I'm with you. Really, I'm with you. It's going to work. It's just that I need this little thing here so I can get the job done. I find it that really works too. And then, I thought what Harold said was great, and you in the back too. Little reminders, including, or talismans, including the talisman of the heart, the uber talisman of the heart, just remembering to sense into the heart and be drawn back to that sensation, or whatever it is that works for us. I think that's really, really, really important. We want to end really soon here, if we could. Not because we're busy. Not because we're going to Australia Sunday morning. You know, none of those things. No, just not. I've transcended it because I'm the teacher. I've transcended it all. Not. All right. Anyway, so. All right. A couple more, then we'll wrap up.
What came to my mind?
That's good. Thank you. That's really good. Okay. Maybe one more, Steve, then I'll make a comment. And then you too. Okay. So, Steve. Great. I want to underline that very often, which drives a busy mind, is our busy brain, is emotional upset. You know, and that's where again things like tuning into the heart, focusing on exhalations. A lot of you probably get the Just One Thing newsletter. I do. This week was on relax. Next week will be on slow down. You know, which I just realized about an hour ago. That's the topic I'll do for next week. So anyway, did you want to make? Yeah, please. Please.
When I finally feel down during the day, there's no pushing my life on my own. I don't know if it's medical, it's just part of the growth for me, but that's the only time I get
Yeah. Is it, so talking about getting quivers, and other people too have different phenomena. So first off, does it feel like an involuntary twitch that feels like a pure, like sensory motor act, or is there a kind of a quiver that has an associated quality of energy and pleasure and even micro bliss? Yeah. That you might know the traditional term, and just because you can name something doesn't mean you understand it. But the traditional term is a kriya. Any of you know that term? Kriya? Yeah. And in the yogic traditions, you know, people have studied those. My personal observation is that some people are quite prone to them, and also at different stages in their practice, people may be prone to them. I myself have not been particularly prone, although I can access a lot of bodily bliss, but it doesn't have that kind of jiggly or, you know, twitchy, you know what I mean, thing. What I've heard about it fundamentally is that it doesn't mean anything. In a sense that it's just, it's kind of like energy moving through in a certain kind of way. I think there are probably people who practice with it yogically to channel it, maybe, and I suspect there are ways to do that skillfully. My intuition, honestly, is to use it to ride one's awareness out in the very spacious, stable presence, right? Where there's content, but even these blissful kriyas or anything else are just more content. Yeah. But you see, it's to use the content to move out into an open space that is not captured by the content. And that's good general advice, I think. So I want to offer one last little thing to wrap and respect the time here for everyone, as well as myself. And I want to say with regard to a way to orient to phenomena, both seemingly, I mean, just whatever flows through the mind, is in the mind to basically say hello and thank you. You know, not even necessarily with words. Because I think that's the essence, in a sense, of clearly knowing. Just like, hello, hello, hello. And a kind of openness, like, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being part of this whole web that nourishes me and supports me and the ones I love. Mm-hmm. Like this sensation, this sorrow, this whatever, you know, hello, thank you. So how about we sit for a minute in hello and thank you, and then we'll wrap up for this evening. Every so often, maybe wordlessly, to see if there's a very soft, gentle hello to whatever flows through the mind, sometimes followed again, perhaps softly or wordlessly, followed by a kind of thank you. Practice help free ourselves and all beings from suffering and its causes. Thank you for your attention and good-heartedness. See you next week. I won't be here, but we will take roll. Not really. Thank you. Thank